Picture it with me. It is the 4th of July in Washington, D.C., one of those perfect postcard kind of days, hot, bright, a little chaotic, in a way only the nation's capital can be on a national holiday. I'm standing outside the White House with two of my girlfriends, one from London and one from South Carolina. We're laughing, doing the full tourist thing. And I've got my daughter with me. She's three, all blonde hair and sunshine, the kind of kid who makes strangers smile just by existing. It's light, it's easy, it's harmless, until it isn't. Because all of a sudden, Secret Service starts moving. And not just casually, not repositioning, they were running, streaming out of the White House from exits I didn't even know existed, heading straight toward the fence line, towards us. And in that moment, I didn't ask what was happening. I didn't look around. I didn't wait to see how everyone else reacted. My brain just said, whatever they're running toward, I don't want to be anywhere near it. And I grabbed my daughter and we moved, fast. No hesitation, no second guessing, just gone. Later, I found out that it was a suspicious item along the fence line. 4th of July, huge crowds, potential bomb. Could have been nothing, could have been terrible. But to be honest, I didn't need to know in that moment. Now, let's look at a different place, a different version of me. I'm overseas, I'm TDY in a conflict zone. Long days, cramped spaces, the work is high stress and also high impact. It's the kind of environment where everybody's operating at 150% and 5% simultaneously because you've all been running too hard for too long. And then the duck and cover alarm goes off. Not a drill, not the least bit ambiguous. The alarm literally tells you what to do explicitly. Duck and cover. Stay away from the windows. And what does my brain immediately want to do? Go look. See what's happening. Get eyes on it. Understand it. Assess the risk. Because that instinct, that need to know, is strong. And to be honest, I'm a curious person. I want to know things. The thing is, when you've been operating in environments like that, where the alarm isn't exactly uncommon, you start to get used to it. You normalize it. You tell yourself it's probably nothing. And even if it's something, the likelihood of direct impact is low, right? In that moment, my instinct was, well, maybe not wrong, but messy. Not malicious, not irrational. The desire to understand the situation is very much human. But that wasn't the time. And spoiler alert, I didn't go to the window. I followed my training and the blaring guidance of the intercom. Welcome to the Unknown Knowns, where intuition meets tradecraft. I'm Dr. Angela Lewis, and this is a space for people who think for a living. Intelligence professionals, leaders, and decision makers navigating complexity, uncertainty, and imperfect information in a fast-paced world. Each week, we explore how intuition, bias, and judgment shape the way we make sense of complexity and how to get better at it. Today's episode is about informed intuition, how to build frameworks that allow you to trust your gut. And I want to explore that with someone who has spent a career making those decisions in real time and building intuition worth trusting. So I'm joined today by, to put it simply, a legend. Every title and description in his bio is more impressive than the last. Daryl Blocker is a recipient of the Distinguished Career Intelligence Medal. He's a 28-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service, where he served as both deputy director of the Counterterrorism Center and chief of Africa Division after leading the CIA's iconic training facility, the Farm. He served multiple tours as a chief of station and was the most senior Black director of operations officer when he retired in October of 2018, with the rank equivalent of a three-star general. Daryl is currently the founder of DMB Consulting Services, a strategic crisis management and executive advisory firm. Daryl serves on one nonprofit board dedicated to improving the future for youth in foster care and advises on another board on countering exploitation and human trafficking of youth and women. He is also a 2025 recipient of the Ellis Island Medal of Honor for exemplary commitment to national security, global stability, mentorship, humanitarian work, and advocacy for diversity and national security. He is my mentor, my dear friend, and one of the very best storytellers that I know. Daryl, welcome.
Dr. Angela Lewis, man, I love the sound of that. Congratulations, my friend, and thank you for having me on your podcast. Now, the first wow moment for me in your opening commentary was not the White House scare or even the war zone bombing. My aha moment was that in 62 years, I never once thought of myself as one who thinks for a living. But you're spot on, as the Brits say, and I'll be thinking about that for a couple of days to come. So We're equally curious, and I am always finding ways to kind of capture things that are in my existence that I've never really been able to define. And thanks for a living. I like that. Thank you.
I love it. In our pilot episode, we talked about the bias blind spot, how our brains are wired to move fast, to simplify, to fill gaps, and how that can sometimes lead us astray. And all of that's true. But today, especially with you, I want to add a layer, because if you work in intelligence or you're an executive making decisions under pressure, we know that you don't always have the luxury of slowing down. Sometimes you have to move. And when you do, you're going to rely on instinct from time to time. But instinct isn't magic. It's pattern recognition. Conceptually, what we call instinct is often your brain picking up on something that's been seen before, or maybe an anomaly in your environment, before you've had time to consciously explain it. There are stories upon stories about situations where something felt off, but maybe nothing overtly threatening had actually happened yet. But that instinct wound up being right. And what's happening in those moments isn't randomness. It's something that the environment, maybe tone, behavior, timing, or context, doesn't match the pattern that your brain is expecting. But instead of surfacing as a fully formed thought, it shows up as a feeling. Your fight, flight, or freeze reaction kicks in and adrenaline spikes. And of course, not all instinct is the same, but the key here is that there is a difference between reacting on bias and reacting on trained judgment. And that's the distinction that isn't really theoretical. So, Daryl, before we get into any of the frameworks, which I love talking about, when you hear about those two moments, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier, the ones that I shared in the intro, one where instinct really got me off the X, and the other where instinct was kind of pulling me in the wrong direction. What resonates with you?
That you're just as human as anyone else. I've long ago stopped trying to understand how my brain works and to learn to trust it, to learn that it understands things and scenarios and situations before I can, almost innately. And that's kept us safe on this planet for a very long time. It's kept us a half a step ahead of those predators that are out there trying to take us. Germs, viruses, other animals, and of course, the most dangerous animal, which is human. So trust your brain. Your brain, it was more than just, you know, what's physically in your body. It is DNA through generations of family. And I truly believe that. Now, the first thing that I thought of is right before we came on air, and it's the 4th of June, 2026. And there was a story on ABC News about this woman who got off the X. A trucker sees this woman running down the highway or running down a back road, handcuffed from behind, and then sprinting with this car kind of weaving behind her. The good news is she got off the X. She recognized that as soon as that guy pulled off on a dark road, she had to come up with a plan. She was already in cuffs in the back seat. He gets out of the car to go to the trunk. She flips her body over the front seat and just takes off, just books. She knows that if she does not get off that X, that it's going to be the end of her. You can't teach that. That is a natural reaction. The will to survive is probably stronger than any others. And if we got any Slow Horses fans out there, there's one episode where the guy who is the head of a red team type security unit gets kidnapped. He gets snatched up in an event, but he escapes twice in the same episode. Now, a lot of people will miss the significance of that, because every time he saw even a small window, they're going to kill me anyway. So they're going to kill me on my terms, not their terms. And now he got captured both times. But the point is, his natural instincts to survive, his natural instincts to get off the X, are what kicks in. And for me, that's the training. Training is the rock solid process that shapes and forms and evolves into instincts. Some call it muscle memory, but I learned early in my intelligence career that for whatever reason, I thrive in chaos. I arrived at Osan Air Base, Korea, in the middle of the largest military exercise that the United States had at the time. It was called Ultra Focus Lens. I'm sure it still exists in some iteration. And it was like something out of a movie. Brand new Second Lieutenant Butterbar, just coming straight from the intelligence school, learning about Soviet weapons and tactics, just to see it real world on an invasion by North Korea to prevent the South Koreans from having a successful Seoul Olympics. This was 1987, 88. It was so chaotic, but I was so calm. I'm like, this is what it's going to be like when it's real. I have to pretend like this is real. If you think otherwise, then it's not helpful, because when it really does happen, all that training is going to kick in if you used it as an experiential learning, if you use it as something to help you not make the same mistakes again. And the intelligence community doesn't want you to not make mistakes. In fact, that's how you learn. What they want you to do is learn from those mistakes and not repeat them, and then continue to build the layers and layers of intuition, instinct, gut feeling, however you want to encompass that. So yeah, I'm curious, but I'm also very careful and calculated in a way that happens faster than my brain can actually keep up with it. But again, I've learned to just let go. It's kind of like on a roller coaster. It's only painful when you're so tense and so tight that nothing happens. But as soon as you let your body just yield to gravity, yield to physics, yield to the inevitable, because you knew when you got on there, it was going to happen. But your brain is like, this is not normal to be shooting down a ramp at 70 miles an hour and do a loop. That's just crazy talk. Who would do this? Well, the body can be controlled, and it's very uncomfortable sometimes. But once you push through that, I've learned that to trust my gut, so to speak. And all of that goes back to training.
I love it. And what you described is exactly that distinction in practice. In intelligence operations, another example of kind of informing your intuition, if you will, are surveillance detection routes, right? At its core, mm-hmm. it's a structured way of answering a very simple question, right? Am I being followed? Is someone paying a little too much attention to what I'm doing? Now, say you're moving through a city and something feels off, you might get that gut feeling. You know, maybe someone shows up twice, a car lingers a little bit too long. But the instinct, that obviously matters a great deal, but it's not quite as simple as just trusting your gut, right? Because that's often the first sort of the first draft of insight. It's your brain flagging that something doesn't fit, even if you can't explain why just yet. But then you have to go back and examine those moments. And you were talking about kind of learning from your mistakes and being able to refine that perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So then people go back and you examine the moment when you felt like something was off. And usually people can then identify exactly what triggered the instinct. But that's only after they've had time to break it down and to take that step back and really recognize the pattern that their brain was picking up on. Could have been a comment that didn't fit, you know, a question that was too personal, a behavior that broke that normal rhythm of interaction. But again, many of these fast-moving situations are high stakes and high risk and too high to rely on just vibes alone, right? It's in an intelligence context, at least. And so then what do we do? How do we leverage instinct while not falling prey to our blind spots, especially in the midst of chaos, right? And this is, as you said, exactly where training comes in. Because if you've trained that instinct ahead of time, you have a framework that allows you to maybe override natural curiosity or the reaction that would have you doing something that might not be the safest or the best course of action. So it's not just vibes then, it's that informed intuition. If you've made a habit of sort of interrogating your thinking, understanding your biases, learning what patterns might actually matter in your environment, right? You know, familiarization, area fam, when you don't have that time to think, you can trust what shows up. You're not just trusting your feelings, you're trusting a pattern that you've already validated. So when you think about that in an operational context, that moment where something feels maybe off, what do you think you're actually paying attention to? What are you paying attention to or recognizing in that moment? What tells you this is real versus, oh, this is just something that I don't need to pay attention to?
Well, the first thing that pops in mind is to trust and not discount immediately whatever that initial thing is. Humans might be the only animal on the planet that talks itself out of a known danger. You'll never see a deer in the woods who's drinking out of a water, who looks up and sees like a little, you know, maybe a glint from a scope and said, there's no danger there. No, as soon as he sees it, he's gone. And he doesn't know why, but he knows through enough experiences that these two things, this happens and then this happens, and I don't want to be on the other end of it. So the second thing I thought of is, and I know, Angie, you know that I'm a huge Jeopardy fan. I watch it every night. But I'm also a puzzle enthusiast, crossword puzzles. So I end every evening or begin every morning with doing three or four crossword puzzles. And almost every single time I missed something on Jeopardy, it was because I discounted my initial, I don't know why that word or that phrase or anything popped in my head. I don't understand it, but it was spot on right. And every time, almost every time that I second guessed myself, it was because I overrode my ability to just trust your body. Your senses are more than just your ears, your eyes, your taste. It is all of those combined. And when all of them are working hand in hand, it's perfect. Like the six tenets that they teach of tradecraft at the farm. Now, separately, almost everyone on the planet has done five of them. And we're not going to get into what those are. But the fifth one you've already, or the sixth one you've already mentioned, surveillance detection routes. That's a skill that you learn. Everything else is situational awareness. And I can look at puzzles and not even read the clue and figure out what some of the words are, just because guess what? There's only so many options. So your brain already is filling in a lot of things just naturally. And again, just learning how to trust that gut feeling. But trusting that gut feeling and getting it right is of course preferable, but trusting that instinct and getting it wrong could be catastrophic in our world. And so maybe it's, you know, the heightened, very real possibility that if you do something wrong, if you make that wrong gut feeling, if you make that wrong choice and drag surveillance to that operational meeting, guess what? That case is blown. That asset is blown. You're probably going to be PNG'd, or they're going to continue to do it and just follow you for a while as they build their case, and maybe something even worse happening. And again, I only mention that because the failures are what I built my career on. And recognizing those failures and why they were failures, it was hard to swallow. I had 360 feedback before a course back in 2002, and I was just coming out of my first field command as a chief of base in West Africa. And by all measures, the team did fantastic. Recruitments, FI production, all of those. But my peers, my superiors, and my direct reports all had the same opinion of my leadership style, and it wasn't positive. And that was probably one of the more painful things that I ever had to experience. And I was 12 years into my career. And I knew that if I didn't learn how to listen, I mean, truly listen to other people, and that means listening not just with your ears, but with your attention span, by sitting there and breathing and listening to what that person is trying to tell you. So again, those mistakes that led to my bad leadership 360 feedback were all correctable. And they were, it was nothing in there that wasn't known to me. No one ever told me that I was a good listener my whole life. I was a straight A student, except for C's and D's in conduct, because Daryl couldn't sit down and keep his mouth shut. So it was no surprise to anyone. But in a career context, I knew that my goal was to retire as a GS-15, a full bird colonel. I come from a military family, a military background, and being the first colonel in the family was, by God, that was my goal. But halfway in your career, you start to realize, well, maybe that goal wasn't high enough. But I knew from that feedback that if I continued down this path of not listening to the people that I'm leading and not listening to my own proclivities all the time, and accepting that other people have different thoughts or ideas or even a workaround to the same solution, could have been ugly. So I learned how to listen. I taught myself how to listen. I read books. I went online. I started following everyone that talked about the topic. And so that was my patchwork for getting to the point where people now call me boss and leader and chief.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that it's such a learning process, right? It's something that we're both doing actively, trying to kind of improve where maybe we are a little bit deficient. But then also, we are naturally doing that in real time too, where we see something and we want to correct for it. We want to shore it up, you know, those kinds of things. And I think it makes it really interesting. There's actually a model for some of what we're describing here. Psychologist Gary Klein developed what's called recognition prime decision making, where expertise, which you develop obviously over time, allows you to recognize a situation and act without having to compare a lot of different options in real time. Now, obviously, that can be challenging when you're in a very short fuse situation, but basically you're compressing experience, right? And that's something that you develop over time. But, you know, once you've developed that expertise, you can compress that. And Klein's research studied how people make decisions in these complex, high-stakes environments, right? When it's something short-fused or fast-paced, and they're talking about firefighters or emergency responders, and really, I would say, intelligence officers, right? You're operating under significant pressure. The need to get it right is pretty critical much of the time. And you talked about kind of what those failures can lead to and how disastrous that can be. The model is especially relevant when decision makers are facing conditions that include time constraints, limited information, which I think strikes pretty close to home. So what does that feel like when decisions are being made out in the field? Does that feel like what it is to be making a decision in the field?
Again, I'm just marveled by how the simplest things and what we know and learn can be kind of encapsulated into a theory, into a management or leadership model, because I can't explain how, from a scientific perspective, intelligence is part art and part science. The science part is, guess what? Human nature has not changed in thousands of years. So if you can get into somebody's ego, if you can get into somebody's good graces, if you can be that protector, if you can be that provider, if you can be that sounding board for that person, all of that builds trust. And at the end of the day, trust is the currency of espionage, of business, of every relationship that you have in your life. If trust isn't there, that relationship is not going to, it's not going to last forever. I think the schoolhouse uses experiential learning from real world cases, from instructor/agents who role play and help the student case officers, the SCOs, recognize that just making a decision and following a lead will come naturally to you once you open up your brain enough to say, I don't know everything, or I don't know what I know, which is the whole unknown knowns. And we'll comment on that later. And everybody's different. Every SCO down there comes at the same problem set with a different angle. And there is no right or wrong. Either it yielded results or it did not. And if it did not, then you go back to that and you try and figure out how to get results out of that. And if it did, you try to build on that. So what they hire for, I think, within the clandestine service is the ability to make good, sound decisions with very little information. My instincts, I boil most scenarios, most situations, whether it's violent or intimate, down to three things: empathy, logic, and reason. That's how my brain is structured. That's my process for thinking. And I've learned that they're intertwined. I can't separate them from one another. Is this logical? What's going to be the impact on this person if X, Y, or Z happens or doesn't happen? If you're not thinking about that person as a human being, no matter who they are, and you know, I spent my career tracing terrorists and around a lot of unsavory people, but I never hated them. I never blamed them for being who they were, because that's how they were raised. Some of them didn't have a choice. Some of them didn't have a vote. If you're born into a cop family, you're probably going to be a cop. You're born into a family of doctors, you're probably going to go into the medical field. If you're born into a family of terrorists, guess what? You're probably going to be a terrorist. Does he have a vote in that? No. Could he have made better choices or different choices? Absolutely. But that clan, that feeling of tribe, that feeling of belonging is really strong. And that's how these young folks across the globe are now being radicalized, because no one really brought them into a loving, caring, trusting environment, and all they know is pain and hatred, which people weaponize and use against innocents. And so are these kids who are lone wolves out there doing terrible things, are they bad people? Yeah, they might be, but they also could be good people who were overwhelmed by the attention from some stranger out there, whether it's a love scam or whatever it happens to be. The human ego is very fragile. And if you learn how to manipulate, then you can use it for good or you can use it for bad. Of course, I always like to think that I use mine only for good. I'm sure there were some times where there was some self-serving situations in there. But again, a very long answer to a short question is, in the field, they have already hired for, trained to, and put you in a situation where they're not going to allow you to fail. They're going to allow you to learn over a period and series of scenarios and situations that you had only ever seen in a schoolhouse text. But now it's real world. And guess what? We trust you, Angie, because we trained you. We know what you have. And guess what? If you make the wrong decision, that's okay, because we talked about this beforehand. We talked about the good, the bad, the unintended consequences that could happen if you go down this path. There's very few scenarios that haven't already been brainstormed or knocked. You know, I would always go in and say, here's what I want to do. I need you guys to knock holes in it. Oh, no, boss, that was a great plan. I'm like, was it really? Was it great because I'm the boss and you guys need me to think that I'm a great boss? Or is it really sound plan? I don't need acolytes. I don't need someone to tell me that my idea is good. It's just an idea, no greater or worse than anybody else. Now, I might come to it a lot more quickly than you might. And that's one thing, but we trust our people from the moment we hire them to protect national security secrets, to protect our nation, to protect our Constitution. And it's not anything that we take lightly. And I think that's kind of lost on most people because, you know, I live here in Los Angeles, so Hollywood has a way of depicting us and who we are. Very, very few examples of any good CIA, good-hearted CIA people out there. They're always the worst in terms of character, like the most despicable person in the entire cast that everybody loves to hate. And that literally was never my experience. Did we have bad relations in embassies with other components within the U.S. government? Of course we do. We're human. But are we the devils that Hollywood would make us out to be? No, we're not.
There are two things that you brought up in that really resonated and I thought were really, you know, worth highlighting. One, you were talking about the decisions that, you know, you're making in the field and, you know, what that looks like. But you also have the people that you are, whether it's targeting or wanting to work with or whatever, they're also making quick decisions in the moment in the field. And so that ability to have empathy and to recognize what they're going through and what they're thinking about and how they're making decisions, when you understand it in yourself, but then you also start to understand it in other people too, and being able to look out for that, like that's so, so critical. That's such an important piece. And the other thing that you brought up that I absolutely loved is just the fact that when you're training people, you're giving them those frameworks and the experience in these different scenarios, because you know they're going to go into the field and they're going to experience these things firsthand. And it's not going to be role playing. It's going to be real. And so you're building, as you said earlier, that muscle memory, right? You're giving them the framework. So when they have to make that snap decision, they're able to reflect on, or ideally not even have to reflect, because it's so ingrained that it's like, I know what to do in this situation. I know which decision to make. So I love both of those. Those are such great points. You know, and it kind of goes back to that recognition prime decision making, right? Klein's model, he found that when presented with those recurring situations, experts generally come up with a quicker decision because the situation is more likely to sort of match a prototypical situation that they may have encountered before. So that's exactly kind of what you're trying to train into them, are those situations. So novices, on the other hand, someone who hasn't had that experience, they have to cycle through different possibilities. They can't make those decisions quite as quickly, or they might use the first course of action that they believe will work, even if it hasn't really been fully tested. So the idea of how that training is taking place, I think, is really, really interesting and kind of aligns with how decisions and education is kind of benefiting the trainees, if you will. And I think there's a few different variations of how this can play out. But in practice, that recognition prime decision making is highly relevant to leaders in high stress fast-paced environments as well. It's exactly what maybe a surveillance detection route is doing. So it's not really teaching you how to think in the moment. It's shaping how you think before you get into that moment. So that when something, you know, feels off, or maybe you're experiencing something that seems really complex, you don't have to just react. You're also recognizing something that actually seems kind of familiar. So I would love to hear if that, you know, aligns with your experience in intelligence leadership in particular, and especially in operational training kind of spaces.
It does. One of the really true joys, and one of the previous chiefs of the operational training told me this, and I didn't have a frame of reference for it. So I didn't really, I'm like, okay, yeah, I hear all these little quips all the time. But he said, students are SCOs, student case officers, assume that because this is a notional scenario, that these are notional stories that were weaved into this scenario and not therefore not real. But every class, all six classes, without fail, there are at least four or five people who would come back after they're already in their first posting and they were at a reception or a scenario, and something happened almost exactly like it happened in the schoolhouse. And they're just like, oh my God, this was so real, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, of course it's real. We're not teaching you things that haven't happened. Every scenario happens somewhere in the world at some point as a teaching methodology, as a teaching lesson that these instructor agents who have proven themselves in the field, who are either targeters, CMOs, ops officers, or SUs who are on the staff and using their years and quite like years and years of knowledge to pass that along. So every time one would reach back to me and say, oh my God, Chief, this is so real. This is happening just the way. I'm like, well, good. We did exactly what we were supposed to. There's actually a schoolhouse scenario where you're teaching the six disciplines. And there was this one young lady who came back from her surveillance detection route week on an away trip. And she just moved with a complete, she was just moving differently. And I saw her, so I called her over to the table in the cafeteria. And she was not one for smiling a lot. But she looked at me, she said, Chief, 2 weeks ago, I thought this SDR training was bullshit. I thought it was not real. I couldn't see it. I was just having trouble conceptualizing how the way you guys were teaching us was actually going to help us do this. And I said, so what changed? She said, well, I was on one run and first thing I said, okay, if what I'm doing is right and the team is deploying the way that we think they're going to deploy, the next person that comes around the corner is going to be this person. And she's like, the first time it happened, I was like, eh. Anybody can guess that. God say it. Then the second time she had it happen, she was like, oh my God, this is real. And then the third time she said, it took everything in my being. It took everything in my power not to do the Snoopy dance because I knew that I finally got it. And I said, how did that feel? And she's like, I don't even know how to describe this feeling. I have never had such an epiphany about something that I thought was bullshit 10 days or 2 weeks ago, that now this, what you've been showing us and teaching us is not, it's not book anymore. It's real world. And either you can do this or you can't. And they're teaching us how to do it. So I need to listen to them. But yeah, when she said I took everything in my power not to do the Snoopy dance, I'm like, yeah, you know, you would have got some debits. You'd have got some notices on that one. He's like, yeah, I know. She said, I was almost would have been worth it to do that. So if you don't trust yourself, how do you expect others to trust you? And trusting you is not being 100% right all the time. In fact, it's not the percentages that are important. It's the learning how to let go of your initial response, which is trained over your lifetime to respond in a certain way. And instead of responding that way, breathe in, count to two or three, and think about what popped in your head, because that's relevant. You don't need to understand why it's relevant. You don't need to understand how it's applicable to this. Trust it. Trust yourself. Trust the training.
For sure. And I love that story because I had a very similar situation happen for me, you know, and when you start seeing it, you're like, ah, there is all of my little ducklings. There they go. They're all in a row. Here they come, you know, and you start to anticipate what's going to happen next because it's an intentional framework, right? And so building those intentional frameworks based on years and years and years and years of experience, not just your own, but, you know, your instructors, and they have honed that, and now they're sharing those frameworks with you. And so that's actually training your intuition and helping you to understand, oh, okay, this is what I can anticipate is going to happen next in this scenario. So it allows you to act or respond a little bit more effectively. Even if you're moving quickly, you're moving within a structure that you've already built or are being trained into. So the SDR example, it's not really built. The SDR itself is not built on the fly unless things have gone off the rails. And that's that's another situation altogether. But to build one effectively, you have to have studied the environment. You need to know what normal looks like, you know, and you need to know what indicators you're looking for, right? And so when something feels off, you're not just guessing. You're rapidly moving through that mental framework. And from the outside, that can look like intuition, like your gut, like, oh, I just know, you know, but it's not coming out of nowhere. You know, it's coming from that experience and that repetition and that, you know, recognition of those patterns that whether you've developed it yourself over time or whether you've kind of integrated those frameworks from instruction into your own. And that way you've kind of built that scaffolding ahead of time. And then when the moment comes, your brain can move without having to move blindly. So I want to be careful, though, because obviously, you know, repetition and experience isn't the same necessarily as training your intuition, too, because if we do something the same way for years, we can just get better at being wrong. Before we wrap up, I want to thank Daryl for sharing his insights and experiences from nearly three decades in the CIA. We've spent this episode talking about how professionals learn to trust their instincts, but there's another side to that story. In part two, we'll explore what happens when familiarity starts to masquerade as truth, why even experienced people can be misled by the patterns they think they recognize, and how intelligence professionals guard against bias in high-stakes environments. Thanks for listening to The Unknown Knowns. We'll see you next time for part two. Be sure to check the show notes for a link to sign up to our podcast mailing list so you never miss a new episode.